it is. It's basketball. It's not a fucking soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Recording this on Thursday, the 20th of February. Stemming from games from round 20, the last of the rounds. First of all, welcome to the program. If you haven't before, subscribe to the show so you get the next one automatically in your feed. What we're going to go through today, or if you're a new listener and you're just coming in for the finals because you heard some NBL buzz, that's great. What I like to do on this podcast is, on this one particularly, I'm going to have a look at round 20 of the NBL through the lens of part analytics, part stats, part eye test, and just what I hear from people I speak to who are in and around the game. I hope. That's the balance I'm trying to strike with this podcast. Gunning for that diamond-shaped slither of the Venn diagram between stats, eye test, and, well, analytics. So, God bless John Venn. Nailed it with the Venn diagram. Looking at this show, we're going to try and do a couple of things, but three main things. We're going to look at home cooking in NBL 20. I must say I'm a little embarrassed by my tweets earlier in the round of round 20. About home cooking, I was preachy and demonstrative, and they don't sit well with me now. No problem with their content, just their tone. I was, as I said, preachy and demonstrative. The other thing we're going to do, we're going to look into the NBL awards, rightly or wrongly. And the other thing we're going to do is we're going to dissect Joey Wright's press conferences and his interview with Dwayne Russell on the Dwayne's World podcast. That's a good listen. Jump over to the iTunes store, type in Dwayne Russell, and it comes up. Let's first have a look at a bit of news. Hungry Jack's has re-upped as the major sponsor of the NBL for three more years. That's pretty good, so we'll continue to see cheeseburgers on free throws. Let's jump into it. Let's look at the awards. So the MVP, and what I firstly want to do is give, for the awards that are a little bit dubious, I want to give my definition as to who and why I got them. So MVP, my definition, the player who, based on this season's performance, you'd take first in a fantasy draft to build your best team. I think the voting went Cotton Machado-Patterson. I haven't got it in front of me. Cotton wins. I think most definitely he was the most valuable player this year. Played the best in the games, was the most impactful for his team, and won the award. I mean, if you took Bryce Cotton out of the Wildcats, your starting lineup would be Damian Martin, Clint Steindl, Tarico White, Nick Kay, and Miles Plumlee. That was what it was till the end of the year. That's a decent team, but no way is that a second top team, 18 wins. That's more of a, if that's a 14, 15 win team back in the rat race of the fourth, fifth, third spot. I think that's more their tune. The voting did go Cotton, Machado, Patterson. I think I would have had Patterson second. I liked Machado. Was a very good player, led the league in assists, really ran that team, and they actually did finish above Brisbane. So actually, maybe I'm not too offended. Coach of the year. So I rate this as the coach who got the best out of his players and thus team for the season. Mike Kelly got 65 votes. Will Weaver got 39. Gleeson a distant third. I felt Will Weaver was pretty hard done by to not see this award. And the reason why is show me, don't tell me. For all the talk of big budget, small budget basketball, the game of basketball doesn't care. A big budget team steps on the floor. A small budget team steps on the floor. The hoop's still 10 feet tall. It's still made out of hardwood. It's about what you produce. Will Weaver had the best record all year, cultivated improvement. Even if you want to say, oh, it's a stack roster that should have won anyway. Well, Brad Newley had a better year than last year by twofold. Daniel Kickett had an immeasurably more impactful and better statistical year than last year. Craig Moller did get injured but was looking really good as well. Sean Bruce, last year, underused, and when he was, it wasn't impactful. Hugely impactful and near sixth man candidate to go from 12th man to sixth man. So that's important. And then there's also the fact of dealing with injuries. Lish, Moller, Bogut. You know, didn't have as many as New Zealand and Adan Shamir, but had more than anyone else in the top four, I would have thought. Bryce Cotton missed one game due to rest, the last of the season. Brisbane didn't have any major injuries. So, you know, that's why I thought he was really hard done by. And also with it's the coach of the year, everyone says, oh, Mike Kelly, you know, from a team that won six games last year to this record. That's true. There's one returning starter. You know, the starters, and that's DJ Newbill. Last year it was Trimble, Newbill, Devin Hall at times, Rob Lowe, who's gone, Lucas Walker was there and starting, Alex Loughton was a starter there. I'm trying to think who was sort of the small forward starter for some of the year, but you know, one returning starter and really only about two or three returning players. Nate Jawai, DJ Newball, Jared Kenny, I can't really think of many others. Maybe Krislovich and a couple of the DPs. So he didn't take a team that was six wins to this year. That team is a thing of the past. Yes, they wore the same singlet, but you know, a lot of people wear the same singlets. It doesn't mean they're coach of the year. But you know, Mike had a nice year. Mike Kelly had a very nice year. But I just don't think that's how the award should be graded, and I don't know if that's how the people voted in the end. Let's jump on to NBL first team. Machado, Cotton, Patterson, Jayson Tate, Nick Kay. Put a little asterisk next to Nick Kay, and I'll tell you why in a moment. NBL second team, Casper Ware, DJ Newball, Scotty Hobson, Cam Oliver, Andrew Bogut. I put an asterisk next to Cam Oliver and Andrew Bogut, and I'll tell you why. Ooh. Does Nick Kay come out of that first team for Cam Oliver? Nick Kay had a really good end of the year, but Cam Oliver was pretty damn good all year. I would have had Cam Oliver in the first team, Nick Kay in the second, and then the asterisk next to Bogut. You know, does he come out for Mitch Creek, I think is the obvious choice. And I think he does, and that's not to diminish his value on the season, Andrew Bogut. He was good, but he did only play 20-some minutes a night. And I think if you asked him in the light of day, he'd probably agree. Mitch Creek was an MVP candidate for a while, got hurt and didn't tell anyone, by all accounts. So I think Mitch Creek deserved to be on that second team and Bogut come out. I don't doubt that teams scouted for Bogut. And I think this does show a bit of a flaw in the voting system where Bogut is a major concern for players and coaches every game they come into. They're always thinking and looking, how can we evade and protect and stop Andrew Bogut? But I don't really think that's what the NBL second team is about. It's about sustained success throughout the year. And for that reason, I think it was Creek. Rookie of the Year, I define this award as the rookie who played the best. First and foremost, I don't think Ball should have been eligible. He played professionally in Lithuania, but he was by the league, so he's considered. I think it is him. Noy missed a lot of time, and there's no one really else in this conversation. If Sunday Dech isn't available, if he's available, I think he wins. I don't think Ball should be available, but in these circumstances where the cards are what they are, Noy missed too many games as well and didn't play as well in those games as LaMelo Ball, so I'm not surprised. Sixth man, I define it as the most impactful player off the bench. The voting went as such: Jason Giddey, 31, Daniel Kickett, 28. I was surprised by this one. I'm happy with Giddey, but I honestly thought it was Brandon Ashley. Especially towards the end of the year, like, he had games where he really started winning games for those teams and closing out games for the Breakers, and they were on a huge run. I think they sort of, won, seven of the last nine or something ridiculous. But that could be way off, but I know they had a really good run towards the end. And he came off the bench every time. Will Magne was eligible, but, Magne didn't start half of the year and then started half the year and was an impactful player only once he got into the starting lineup. He wasn't that guy who was coming off the bench, the actual sixth man role. This award to me, and maybe I'm off my hinges, but is about who comes off the bench, who is the best, not who just didn't happen to start and started half the games and was better when he was a starter. Yeah, that's not how I see the award. So I would have had it going to Brandon Ashley. Most improved. My definition of this award is player who has made the biggest leap to become impactful on games. I've said that a lot now, impactful on games. That's my definition. The voting went as such: Will Magne, 53, Dane Pinot, 49, Sunday Dech, 27. I was surprised not to see Bruce in and around those three, but when you look at those three, Magne, Pinot, Dech, like, did Bruce have a bigger improvement than Dech? Probably not, so no, I'm not hurt by it. I like this thing. Magne went from bench obscurity to primetime starter and was near defensive player of the year candidate. Pinot did great in his minutes and was impactful as well, but wasn't that explosion player who turned games like Magne. Pinot was around in every game. Now, it's where you put your worth here, and it's up to you guys. Do you put it on someone who is goes missing in some games but explodes in others and turns three games on his own dime? I mean, that win against Sydney doesn't happen without Will Magnay. Or do you give it to someone like Penaud, who was just not never in the foreground, always in the background, but of plays, of wins? Their tail off in wins towards the end of the year also hurt his chances for this award, I feel. So no, I'm definitely happy with Will Magnay. I thought he went from, you know, role player, if not even bench player, to, you know, a starting centre and a near star in the NBL. Defensive player of the year, tough one. DJ Newball win it with 46 votes. Magnay is close behind on 42. Bogut 33. No Mitch McCarron on this list. I think there's a lot of hype for him for Defensive Player of the Year. Mitch McCarron, you sort of see it around the traps on Twitter and whatnot, where people say, oh, Mitch McCarron, you know, wow, what he does defensively. To not get in the three, I'm not too surprised. I think that's a little bit of sports pseudo-intellectualism with Mitch McCarron. I thought he had a good defensive year, but you know, what else was he going to do? He wasn't scoring. I actually liked Bogut or Magnay for this award, and I really don't know who to split it to. I mean, Bogut was the linchpin of the number one defense in the NBL by a long way. You know, these two really altered a lot of shots, whether they blocked them or not. I don't really care for stats on defense. I think stats are really just misleading on the defensive end. People were terrified of these two. They turned games on defense on the regular, and considering Bogut missed games, I'd kind of say it was Will Magnay who's the best defensive player of the year. His second half of the year, he had games where he's blocking heaps of shots, but guys were terrified of coming in. And my favourite is the game where Mitch Creek went, got blocked twice, and thereafter was completely ineffective out of the game. When you can take an MVP candidate out of a game, that's pretty special when you're a defensive player. Bogut just didn't play the amount of minutes and missed three games. Three games doesn't sound like a lot when you say it. One, two, three. But in a 28-game schedule, it's more than you think. Let's jump on. Let's have a look primarily at the games of round 20. First game, Melbourne versus Cairns. This was the primo game of the round. Once this game was played, there's a little bit of loss of interest going out of the rest of the games because you knew what was going to happen as far as the playoff picture is concerned. David Barlow, 15 points, 7 rebounds, 3 of them offensive. Chris Golding, 23 points, 4 assists. When CG43 and Barlow both score in double figures, the Melbourne United are 9 wins, 0 losses, and these 9 wins include wins over Perth, Sydney, Brisbane, the Breakers, and now Cairns. That's everybody in the top 4 and just out of it. The great game from them piggybacks on something Homicide and I had a chat about in our last podcast, and you can go back and have a look at it. We both predicted Cairns to win this game, perhaps foolishly. Melo Trimble. But as I was saying, piggybacks on something we were talking about. Melo Trimble's a 25-year-old. Sean Long is 27 years old. They've won a total of 18 games in the NBL last season. They're still figuring out how to win. And them not being able to defer to the injured Casey Prather in winning time, as Homicide put it, has cost United big time in NBL 20. I asked Homicide the question, can't Chris Golding be that guy? Can't he be that guy that this team defers to in the winning moments? In this game, he was that guy, and even in the game against Illawarra as well. This takes me back to the pair's woes earlier this year, referring to Long and Trimble. Long and Trimble were called everything from selfish, lazy, no good, to stuff like they're the problem. They've come in and they're the problem. Chris Golding is this team's star. It's on him. He's the mature statesman as well. It's on him. It seems to me that people would prefer to put the blame on, as Jim Maxwell, the cricket commentator, put it, the Americans. And I think we can all read between the lines on that little tone inflection. They'd rather blame it on the Americans than look at the pillars of your team that have been there since 2012. That's 8 years for Golding. Have overseen the name change, have overseen the championships, and David Barlow, who's been there with the club since 2014, they've been a part of championships, they've been a part of culture. They are Melbourne United from its absolute genesis. Rather than look at them, we'd rather just say, oh, it's the Americans. It's the new guys. How fragile is a franchise when it can be derailed by two young guys in their 20s, when you've got guys in their 30s there. It's their team to step up, and they finally did it, and I'm proud of them. I just don't buy it. Third quarter, Vickerman in a timeout after Cam Oliver dunked dunked all over Sean Long, or a dunk that was poorly defended by Sean Long. Vickerman says in the timeout, "This is our season. You can't fucking float around." And that was directed directly at Sean Long. Not a terrible thing. Most players just need that strong instruction, and I think he's one of them. Trimble, 19 points, 7 of 9 from inside the three-point line. He's the best attack at the basket in the NBL. His body control in the air, his strength across his shoulders for a small guy, unbelievable. And he absolutely hammered the league in free throw attempts. Turnovers. Melbourne committed 7. Cairns had 17 plus 10. It was a symptom of one-out stuff. They didn't know. They went to water against in a big game. DJ Newell had 4. Machado had 4, but none in the fourth quarter for Machado. Points from turnovers, 19 for Melbourne, 6 for Cairns. And then the fourth quarter was when most of them, 31-16 in that fourth quarter for Melbourne, just quietly. Newell, Jerich combined for 1 of 7, and Noi were all off the boil for Cairns Taipans. Nate Jawai, 12 minutes, 15 seconds, 16 points, 7 of 8, 3 rebounds, did not play a minute in the fourth quarter. The question was put to Mike Kelly in his presser. He replied, "I think he could have played a few more minutes. No minutes restriction. He wasn't injured or anything is what he meant. Nate's been fantastic. We got down and I wanted a quicker group." He seems like he just sort of forgot that Nate Jawai was on his list. And my question to you guys out there is, does a coach of the year make this omission of detail in such a big game, or relatively big game for form going into the finals for them anyway? Does a coach of the year make this omission of detail? Probably a little bit unfair to Mike Kelly to pose that question and put that decision and coach of the year so close together. But nonetheless, I wanted to ask it. Here we go. Home cooking. Free throw attempts. Melbourne had 10, Cairns had 17. Fouls. Melbourne committed 19, Cairns committed 16. Don't tell me, show me with the home cooking. I've just had a gutful. Nick Tan, on Twitter, who's a friend of the show, and I hope he doesn't mind me giving his first and last name, he rightly said to me, "A favourable home whistle is not just the calls, but the non-calls and tone of the officiating in the game." Couldn't agree more with Nick. That's very true. But I just didn't see it in this game. And this was the game. If the NBL ever had any recipe for home cooking, and a favourable home whistle is what I'm talking about, if ever there was that ingredient in the NBL, we would have seen it in this game. This is the one they needed Melbourne to win to get through. There wasn't any sense of it. Now, you could probably say Melbourne had this game in hand and there was no need for the home cooking. And I say, well, that's pretty handy, isn't it? And also very, very, very skeptical and very droll. Putting aside whether home cooking happens or not, what I hate about the home cooking discussion is a couple of things. One, it diminishes the role of the players. If someone had cried home cooking on this game, or a favorable home whistle, if someone had cried a favorable home whistle on this game, it would have totally diminished the role of Chris Golding and David Barlow in this game. So you just crap on your talent. Two, it's so weaselly, pathetic, weak, and insipid. Oh, we lost the... If you're at home, oh, we lost the game. Oh, the ref was against us. Like, courage up, you know? Come on. We're better than that as a society, I'd like to feel. Three, it drags down the conversation about the game in the league to its bargain basement bare minimum. If you think that a ref, like, this is the NBL, it's not the NBA, it's not a huge stakes game, this is not a big money turner. If you think there's some sort of underground, like the refs are like, yeah, put through the... No. Now, with home, are we talking about refs being persuaded by a home crowd? I actually don't feel that's the case at all. I just feel it's the referees' particular personalities and their interactions with the players. Now, does a player have the right to argue with calls? Absolutely. Does Chris Golding have the right to get a bad call, sit on the floor, and hold the ball at the referee like a smart ass? Of course he does. That's where the interaction with the refs is fine and that's where it exists. But when it goes outside of that and it can be so categorized and so cataloged as, yeah, this is the home team getting an advantage, it really bugs me. Fourth reason why home cooking as a slogan just rolls off the tongue. I've said it now 15 times. It just rolls off the tongue. It's a bumper sticker. If you saw home cooking with a little pot and a thing in it, it just rolls. It's hashtag BS. It's the sporting equivalent of talk to the hand or don't go there or I didn't do it, if you've seen The Simpsons. It's catchy, but ultimately lame. So my advice is home cooking, don't go there. Don't go there. Don't go repeating it. I believe calls go wrong all the time. Is the standard of refereeing good? Yeah, modest. Is it a result of some hidden ulterior motive? No. I've got it written here. I believe calls go wrong, but is there a premeditated malice or unconscious bias based on home court ritualistically? No, not that I've noticed. Maybe I'm letting my utter disdain for whinging disrupt my thinking on this issue. But there is a reason why this country isn't yet a republic. People love to emulate the UK and its whinging culture. Quick question, and I will ask, is why didn't 2019 Referee of the Year Michael Allen referee this game? If he's Referee of the Year, I know he was referee last year and this year when Devon Mabry. Why didn't he do this game? It's a big game. Don't you want all your best? I know he was over in New Zealand for the Breakers and Southeast Melbourne. Yeah, just interesting. I think we're talking about a favourable home whistle. I think the conversation should be more directed at the individual referee talent. I've lingered on this enough. Let's go on to the second game. New Zealand Breakers, Southeast Melbourne. New Zealand winning this one 92-83. Not enough for their percentage. Knocked out of the finals. Hobson, Abercrombie, Lowe and Henry all really good in this game, I thought. Abercrombie and Hobson especially. Rob Lowe, whew, 18 points, 70%. This team was unlucky with the finals. Injuries and the leaky roof in Illawarra especially. What do they do next year? I'm going to go into this in more depth in a later podcast, but should Matt Walsh and management re-up in NBL 21? That's my question. If this team just went, yeah, let's reset the decks and went through, what happens? Well, let's have a look. Hobson, 30 years old. Abercrombie, 32 years old. Rob Lowe, 28 years old. Sec Henry, 32 years old. Brandon Ashley, 25 years old. Finn Delaney, 24 years old at present. Do those ages marry up to a re-up in NBL 21? I don't know. Interesting. Also, what to do about Corey Webster, who's in transit from China, maybe in quarantine. No, he's not in quarantine. He's signed through 2022, not just next year, but the year after. Would he accept a sixth man role? Is he a Ewing Theory candidate? I'm not going to answer it and give an indication. You guys just let that ponder in your brainstems. Southeast Melbourne, on the other hand, shorthanded. No Mitch Creek is their best player. Gibson and Pino were really good. Gibson, 4 or 5 from the field, from the outside, pardon me. Pino, 7 rebounds, 6 of them offensive. I just thought he was, his ability to get a nose for the ball and get position and not concede that position, despite being perhaps smaller than others, really good. But Breakers winning this one. Let's jump on to the third game. Sydney hosted Illawarra, winning it 98-82. Was it any surprise? My question coming out of this one, because he had a good one, is Deshaun Taylor a starting point guard in NBL 21? Is there a team where he could come in? Question for you guys. Was this the last we see of David Anderson in the NBL as a player or coach? You know, what's his future with basketball? Really interesting. On a scale of 1 to 10, how pleased were the Hawks to see the end of the season, and Todd Blanchfield especially? 10 out of 10. They couldn't wait to see the end of the year. Ogilvy and Boone. Let's talk about this. Are they the subject of career assassination? What was Flynn and GM Matt Campbell and ownership thinking? Both are down in every statistical category on their career numbers and last season, except steals for Ogilvy. But then again, the Hawks played enough defense that that was going to happen. They certainly didn't play a lot of offense and make shots. It was unfair. It was, I don't want to say cruel, because I don't think it was, it obviously wasn't intentional. They wanted good years out of everyone. They didn't want to lose, but it was an odd choice to go with those two especially when you had Ogilvy under contract. I thought one gives you as much as the other, or even if one doesn't give you as much as the other and you thought you could get more out of Boone, you've committed to Ogilvy, and later there, Sam Frohling. So you kind of had it. You had your starter, you had your backup at a spot that's, you know, where tall, slower guys in the NBL tend to struggle. It's been a very undersized centre league with very few exceptions. But that was that game. Let's jump on to the next one. I think some birds making a strange sound. Fourth game of this round, Brisbane hosted the Cairns Taipans, winning 124-88. Wow. Brisbane scored 39 in the first quarter, which was an incredible quarter. Cam Glidden hit 7 of 14 three-pointers. Closest to that number of three-point attempts was 8 in late November. We're now in the middle of January. And he did that against Melbourne United. He took 120 attempts this season. He took 14 in this game. That's more than 10%. Glidden had 42 three-point makes coming into this game. This season, this game made up 16% of his makes. That's a lot. In 28 games, that's a lot for one game to have that much. In comparison to last season, from the three-point line, Cam Glidden made 137 makes from 339 attempts. This season, he made 49, a third, let's say, of 120 attempts. Again, less than a third. Almost a third. Down 60-some percent year to year. It's not good. Cairns had 27 turnovers in this game. What were they a symptom of? Honestly, my answer, mental fatigue. They just looked like they it didn't matter to them, and it showed. But not that they weren't trying or didn't care or didn't want to win. You know, you obviously want a bit of form going into the finals. I just felt they've fatigued. They've played a lot of minutes in big games and in a fast-paced system. Machado had 6 turnovers. That's uncharacteristic. He had 10 turnovers for the round, Machado. I felt the others were referring to him too much. There was less off-the-ball action. I don't know. It was a hard one to tell. Fifth game of the round. The Perth Wildcats and the Adelaide 36ers. Holy moly. 94-79. A pretty lackluster effort from the Sixers. I think most of them would agree. In fact, they did. They conferred and confirmed it in their press conferences. Some of the 36ers didn't feel like playing, and I didn't feel like watching. I only watched the first half and speckled through the second, just being honest with you guys. Eric Griffin, quarter one, checks in at the 4:47 mark. One defensive rebound, 3 turnovers, subbed out at the 2 minute and 20 second mark. Would not return for the game. It wasn't just from his play in this game either, but we'll go into that. My question for everyone out there listening. Did Joey Wright let personal vendettas get in the way of a winning season? My answer, that's a question for you. My answer is no, I don't think so. I think some of these players were destined to fail with the way they seemingly, and how they've been spoken about, how they've treated the game. The game, their team, their players and teammates. Little things. Let's go back all the way back to November 25. Eric Griffin writes on Twitter, "Finally got my blue check on Instagram." Let's go back to October 8th, even further back. He writes again, "I just want to ball in the NBA." Some of the replies are interesting. One says, "Use my Sixers as a gateway." What an interesting line. Use me. It's like in Pulp Fiction, like, you know, get the gimp. The gimp's sleeping. The 36ers are not, use me. Use me, use me. What's that song by Bill Withers? Use me. Use me? Use my 36ers. Just felt interesting. Another one replies, "You can do this. Keep putting in the work and praying for strength." It's like he's in a concentration camp. Like you can get through this. Playing basketball for the 36ers. And I think that came out in Joey's press conferences where he said, you know, guys need social media to get up, and if you can't play the game for the love of it. It all seems to kind of be in this cooking pot here. Speaking of Joey Wright in his press conferences, this was unreal for twofold. And let's go through all the major quotes. I've got them all written down because I couldn't look away. I talked about it before, but let's do it. He's talking about the modern era. This is when guys, they have to have a reason to play. In modern society, that's far too often. They get so much reinforcement from social media, that's what they grow accustomed to make them get out and play. If you can't get out and play for the sheer love of the game, then something's wrong, and something was wrong. Ooh. On Eric Griffin, he was asked, why didn't you play more minutes? He wasn't interested in playing tonight, so I wasn't interested in playing him. Said the similar thing of Jerome Randall. The key line difference being he wasn't as bad, but just didn't normally give us what he gives us. He then goes on to say, and this is where if you're not a Joey Wright fan, you got to listen to this. I really love this game. Sorry for the big truck. I really love this game. I use this sport to affect people in a positive way. It really distresses me when individuals It really distresses me when individuals don't and use the sport for selfish reasons. And we had a lot of guys, more than one, so it's not just Griffin, a lot of guys this year who use the game for selfish reasons. Again, it is no way three or more of these guys were going to come out and play for me on the 500. That just wasn't going to happen. If anything, they were going to play worse. He then doubled down on that in an interview with Dwayne Russell, in which he said that you could see statistically when the leak from Body Nodge came out about Joey not being there, you could see whose numbers dipped statistically. You could see they were playing for the next contract, and then when it was like, oh, I got to still kind of be on the side of Joey Wright, he might be here. And then when it was like, oh, he's not going to be here, plug pulled. And he said, you can tell who that is statistically. I haven't had the chance to go back and have a look yet, but I will, because I'm hoping to do another podcast about everyone's season and the finals looking forward. Where was I? It's not, but he said, go on, we wanted to say about the 500 wins, 500 coach games. It's not about me. It's about playing the game of basketball the way you should play the game of basketball. And if you can't do that and you totally just want to take from it and pillage from the game, it's not somebody I want to be around. No one cost me a job. This season is on me. I'm paraphrasing there, but wow. Pillage. There's players on the Adelaide 36ers who pillaged from the game of basketball. The other thing with that, pillage, we know what precedes pillage. Genghis Khan didn't just pillage. And warning, you know, war. He raped. And you can't just pillage. You rape and pillage. There's guys on the 36ers doing that. Unbelievable. This story isn't over. Daniel Johnson was also a part of this press conference. I wanted to talk about his part in it. He was just sad. Like, I saw a broken man. I saw it when they lost to New Zealand in New Zealand, and I saw it again here. And he says, and I quote, some of the guys that didn't get up are the guys that haven't been here that long. Again, giving an indication of who they are. I mean, it's been a tough couple of weeks. It's no excuse. Guys should have come out and play hard. We're talking about playing hard in a pro league. Some of the effort wasn't there from people, and that was disappointing. My estimation of Daniel Johnson as a player and as a person went a lot higher after this. I thought he was open. I thought he was honest. I don't want to say fragile, but I think he was. But he was just—he was open, and I really, really appreciated it. And he still put in an effort and played quite well. He's got his limitations as a player. I've spoken about him in the past. But on the whole, I'll say this. I don't think he's ever pillaged from the game or played for selfish reasons. I hope not, anyway. Nick Kay. Let's go to Perth. Let's go to the positives here. Nick Kay, 23 points. Boy, he's coming to form. Plumlee had a better game, 14 points. Clint Steindl, 14 points, shooting with confidence. They all scored all those points on a combined 19 of 33, 58%, with only one turnover between the three of them. And Nick Kay did a lot of sort of secondary playmaking in this game. And, you know, Plumlee's been known to turn over. Steindl was just catching and looking to shoot. And he's better when he does that. I'm not a huge fan of players resting. I've spoken about that on the podcast before. But Perth did get to rest. Bryce Cotton and Tarico White being probably the one who needed it more. and this was probably for the best against the insipid 36ers. I never like to see players rest. I also feel it's kind of unnecessary. Just take them, but just don't play them the minutes and just have them sipping Gatorade. But, you know, I'm not a doctor. I just play one in real life. Game 6, Southeast Melbourne, Melbourne, 90-109. Sean Long's defensive activity was exceptional early on. A little mechanical and robotic looking, but effective on the shows and the hedges and all that sort of blah, blah, blah. You know, screen would be made, he'd be jumping out, he was active with hands up. I liked it. Melbourne shot 51% from the outside, 17 of 33. Chris Golding himself, 6 of 11. Woo. This round, Chris Golding took 12 and 11 for a total of 23 three-point attempts this round. 23 three-point attempts. He averages 9.3 a game. So this round, you know, 12 and 11, he basically took an extra two or three threes a game. And it made all the difference. Again, two or three, oh, that doesn't sound that important. That's just on the average. So he's had games where he took a lot less than that. But 2 or 3 points above his average. So 30% on top of his average. That's a lot. And it was not so much him taking the shots. It was the way in which he was getting them and the focus on him getting those shots. Melbourne looked dangerous. I don't think this was just they beat two bad teams, or Cairns, who are a good team, had nothing to play for, and Southeast Melbourne, who weren't good, although they were underhanded, and I think they still tried, but they just were running out of speed. Ty West has had an odd year all year. I actually thought Melbourne looked good. If they are able to absolutely catch fire from three-point line, and if you can do that, you can steal games off people, even the Sydney Kings. David Barlow, again, 18 points, didn't miss a shot. Good for him. Another game in which those two, Chris Golding and Barlow, combine for double figures and they win. Takes it now to, what, 10-0 or 11-0? I can't remember if that initial number took into account that win over the weekend. That was the round 20 that was. Let's look at the finals and do this quickly. I'm going to do a much greater in-depth look at the finals, but if you're a first-time listener, I want you to get the idea of why these finals are pretty neat. First final. Sydney Kings take on the Melbourne United. Sydney own the season series 3-1. Melbourne won once in Melbourne. They've never won in Sydney this season. Melbourne are the third best offensive rating and the fourth best defensive rating. Sydney are holders of the eighth best offensive rating and the number one by a long margin defensive rating. Long, long way on the rest of the league. The series kick off, I think, late Feb, 28th, I think. Sits in my mind, maybe sooner. And the first game is this one, though, Perth and Cairns. Cairns own the series 2-1, winning in Perth earlier in the year, way, way earlier. I forget when. I think it was October. I think it was the third game of the year or something like that. I don't read too much into that loss. That was the Dario Hunt version of the Wildcats that has now obviously changed a heck of a lot. And earlier in the year when Wildcats didn't seem to have their best foot forward, or poor. Perth have the number one offensive rating, which I was a little bit surprised at, but nonetheless, and the second best defensive rating in the NBL. Cairns, on the other hand, have the sixth best offensive rating and the third best defense, which I was a little bit surprised to see as well. I thought they'd be a better offense than defensive team, or at least have the better ratings than that, but they don't. More than these stats are the fact that Cairns are the worst defensive rebounding team in the league, and Perth are the second best defensive rebounding team in the league. I think Cairns are going to have to look at what they're going to do on the backboard. Cairns are the team that turns the ball over the most in the NBL. Perth are the team that turns it over the least. We're talking chalk and cheese. We're talking cats and dogs, pardon the pun. We're talking snakes and ladders. Despite the season record of 2-1, I don't think this season's series is going to be. Maybe Cairns can. I don't know. I'll talk about that more in a later podcast, a finals edition. Just want to go on a quick. The last couple of things. Talking points. I got three of them and then we're out of here. Attendances. They're all up mostly. Breakers are up 37%. 36 is up 19. Bullets up 19. Kings up 17. Hawks up 10. Taipans up 2. Perth still hold their average of almost 13,000 fans a week. Melbourne must be down, presumably. They're the only team that doesn't get a mention. And South East Melbourne, who don't have any records to compare. What does this tell me? it tells me winning is a pretty important key to monetary success in the NBL. But the problem is, not everyone can win. But that it was a pretty key ingredient for certainly, you'd say the Kings. And then, you know, I mean, I don't know what attendance is, whether they improve for the Breakers and the Bullets once they started winning. But winning doesn't seem to be everything. I mean, the 36ers are up 20%. Their team last year was far more enjoyable to watch and won more. So, you know, it's not just that. It's, I think you look at it, it also is an element of, if you build it, they will come. 36ers moved to a bigger building, more people came. Brisbane moved to maybe not a bigger venue, it's hard to tell, but a better venue by all accounts. A venue that had atmosphere, and everyone loves a new venue. Both up 19% parallel. I haven't been to these two cities, and I haven't seen whether these two arenas are better or easier to get to for both public transport and just transport in general. That's for the, I've got some very keen 36ers and Bullets listeners. If you're listening, let me know about the logistics of the city. I want to know, you know, is this a matter of like, oh, the Sixers are playing, oh, it's a hop, skip and a jump down the road, whereas the Clipsal Powerhouse perhaps wasn't, or the old Armory wasn't in Brisbane. I'm sorry to say I haven't been to your cities in a long while. I don't know. But do, please get in touch with me. I'd love to know. The other thing I had with, you know, the Breakers up 37%. I'd love to chat to Matt Walsh and management about how they did that. I wonder how big a deal, whether positive or negative or a detriment, New Zealand Breakers moving their games around the country were. Was it a help or a hindrance to their attendances? Did people, you know, did the fact they took it to Horncastle and all these different places, all these different arenas, did that, you know, tap into a support base that they didn't have? I would have thought taking it away from your biggest city and your major sponsor, major supporters, would diminish the product, because you're taking, you know, product away from people who you're most trying to capture. So, interesting question, and I'd love to speak to someone about the Breakers about it, and I'll try and track someone down. I've been talking about this all year and no one else has. Kendall Stevens and free throw attempts. I think this is amazing. He made it. He flipping made it. He played 339 minutes for the season and didn't take a single free throw attempt. The nearest player who also played but didn't attempt a free throw was Nick Pozoglou. He played 43 minutes. He was the next highest minute getter without a free throw, to put that in comparison. Pozoglou, 43 minutes. Stevens, 339. Almost 300 more minutes. That's basically the whole of Titanic more. Again, to put it in comparison, Deshaun Taylor played 327 minutes, 12 minutes less than Kendall Stevens, yet attempted 42 free throws. What an incredible stat. What a crazy season. To put, and then again, to put 339 minutes in relative terms, that's the equivalent of watching the movie Titanic. Lovely film with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, Billy Zane. He jumps aboard the Titanic on a ship he's won in a card game. He's just expecting to get a trip back to America because it's leaving from Southampton, obviously, in 1916, we know this. 1912, sorry. And it's traveling back from Southampton to England. He thought he just won a ticket over the United States, but what he really won is a ticket to life and to the love of his life. In Kate Winslet. You can watch that film 1 1/7 times. It's a 3.5-hour movie in the same amount of time that Kendall Stevens played on an NBL court and didn't shoot a free throw. Home cooking, maybe. Betting on the NBL. If you're thinking about betting on the NBL, this does not do my lack of home cooking argument any cred, but of the 126 contests this year in NBL 20, 79 were won by the home team. That's 63% of winners on the home team. Imagine if you just were a little bet on the home team, but just were a little bit suspicious and took a little bit of cash off the Illawarra Hawks. You'd be picking games at a pretty damn good rate. That's the show. Thanks very much for listening. Jump onto your apps, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever, and give the show a rating out of 5 stars. You can pick 1 star, 2 stars, 3 stars, 4 stars, or 5 stars, whatever floats your boat. Jump on there. You can also give us a review. You could type something like, "I really enjoyed this show. Thank you very much." Or you could say something like, "This show is terrible and I hate it, and anyone who listens to it should go and do something horrible to themselves." It's your choice. Nonetheless, I've got more podcasts coming out. I've got an interview with Catapult Sports, who do the logistical stuff for the NBL. They have the underwear that checks people's vitals and keeps players. It's all about load management. We've got that. I'm hoping to get others on to talk about the playoffs and finals. But interesting stuff coming up. Really looking forward to the finals. I think everyone else is. Thanks very much. Ciao.